Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The View From Here on KGVM 95.9 FM in Bozeman. We are talking this week with our guest, Kirsten Ewai. Kirsten is the executive director of Forward Montana and Forward Montana Foundation. She previously fought the climate crisis as a campaigner with Stand.Earth and the Sierra Club. Kirsten earned her Master's of Public Administration from Montana State University. She also served survivors of domestic violence with the local nonprofit Haven and co-founded Earth Tone Outside MT, an organization dedicated to elevating the visibility of Montana's diverse outdoor enthusiasts. In her time away from working to advance justice, you can find Kirsten exploring in the mountains or dancing in the streets. Too bad we're not going to have music on Maine this week to check that out, but hopefully we'll be back soon. Welcome, Kirsten.
Thank you.
So to start off, would just be interested in hearing about how you came to Bozeman, what your path into activism would be, and into getting involved in becoming the executive director of Forward Montana.
Absolutely, and that's a very big question, so I'll try to keep it succinct for now. So I grew up in San Diego, California, very different from Bozeman, and little Kirsten would not have imagined that grown-up Kirsten would be living in a place like this. I grew up at the beach, and I was really lucky to have parents who really loved being outside and hiking and camping, and so a lot of my childhood was spent car camping, going to national parks, on road trips, that sort of thing. But anything beyond that, like, we grew up in a city, so like anything beyond that was sort of like this cool thing that I saw in like glossy magazines. But from that experience growing up, I really became passionate in preserving the environment, and through high school started learning about climate change. And then when I was in college, a lot of these things really clicked, that the climate crisis was really upon us, although we weren't calling it the climate crisis at the time. The divestment campaigns were really huge, and I was getting involved with local efforts on campus. My first, I guess, foray into activism was trying to get a petition started in my dorm to get composting. That was a very failed effort, but nonetheless, I think what really kicked off things, and I worked for our Center for Gender Equity on campus, and from there I was really starting to make these connections on environmental and climate issues that we were facing, along with a lot of the gender violence that was happening in the States and also abroad. And so after college, I was like many people, I knew what I was interested in, but didn't really know what to do. To me, I had thought, like, in order to affect change in the environmental world, you have to either be a scientist or a lawyer. But it wasn't until I came across this entry-level program with the Sierra Club that I realized that there's this whole other world out there of organizing. And this really changed my view on everything, on how you can affect change, that it doesn't necessarily need to be through legal battles, although those are very effective, and it doesn't necessarily also need to just be scientific papers, which are also very important, but it's all of these things combined, as well as mobilizing and working with people. And so that's really how I got started, was at the Sierra Club as a young organizer in Los Angeles before moving out here to Bozeman.
And so when you came to Bozeman, you did some work with the Sierra Club here also, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I worked here for a few years on wildlife and lands conservation, and it was during that time that the Bozeman office of Forward Montana was just starting. This was probably, I moved here in 2014, and I think the Bozeman office opened around 2015. And I met Kia Abbey, who just left the organization in the fall as the deputy director. And I was just so amazed and impressed with how she was bringing young people together to talk about issues that they really care about, registering voters, and more importantly, training young people and giving them the skills and tools that they needed to succeed and create the change that we always talk about that we'd like to see. And so that's how I first started getting involved with Forward Montana, was helping out with these trainings and really using the skills that I was learning at the Sierra Club and helping other young people gain those skills as well.
So Forward Montana is very much a youth-driven organization. Can you tell us a little bit about how it got started and a little bit about what that orientation brings to your work?
Yeah, absolutely. So Forward Montana was started in 2004 out of Missoula by a group of students at the University of Montana. And really, upon our founding, it was university and local issues. So talking about sexual assault and a lot of the crisis that was helping, that was going on there, recycling, things like that. And since 2004, we've expanded. We're a statewide organization that is led by young people for young people, All of our staff is under 30. I'm the oldest at 28. And we have year-round staff in Great Falls, Billings, Bozeman, and Missoula now, which is really exciting.
So what are some of the current priorities and campaigns that Forward Montana is addressing?
So at Forward Montana, we believe in peer-to-peer. Our theory of change centers on peer-to-peer engagement in the life cycle of a voter, and also providing a home for people to advocate on the issues they care about. So we run the largest third-party voter registration drive in the state of Montana. Each year we register thousands of voters. Oftentimes our voters are young and people of color, and that's what we specialize in, is really outreaching to communities who are overlooked and marginalized from our democracy. And so from voter, once we get people registered to vote, we also provide them with a tool so that they can cast a ballot in an informed way and matches along with the issues that they care about. So we have a very popular voter guide program and voter education program that informs folks like, what's the Secretary of State? What is the Public Service Commission? Some of those, what we call Tier B races that you might not know about, as well as like, where do certain candidates across all parties fall on some of these issues that have been identified. And then from there, we run a large voter mobilization effort where we get people to turn in their ballot. So in 2018, Montana saw the largest increase in the youth vote out of any other state in the country, which we were super excited about, with 40% of young people that we talked to more likely, or young voters were 40% more likely to vote if we had talked to them. And so that peer-to-peer engagement is really what drives us. And through all of this, we are weaving in leadership development opportunities. Forward Montana really believes in the power and efficacy of young people to create the change that they wish to see in the world, and also to run organizations and to be effective and to be young professionals. And so I think that really sets us apart from maybe some other organizing and civic engagement organizations that are out there in the country, is that we don't have like a separate canvas office. Like, our organizers are deeply involved into everything that we do.
If I may jump in, this is Steve Kirkhoff, co-host with Jeff Milchen. Kirsten, I was taken by your personal, your autobiography of growing up in San Diego and having parents who were enthusiasts for outdoors and took you to national parks, and you did your car camping and all that wonderful stuff, which made you apparently have some sense of stewardship for land resources and turned you maybe... So I'm going to ask you to fill in my dots, but maybe turns you toward a sort of more activist approach to your way of living.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a teacher, an instructor at MSU, and I've taught thousands of students, and I would say that you are by far the minority in terms of your personal commitment. In fact, you know, what you're doing now is so far beyond what most students would ever care to do. In fact, one thing I've noticed in many of my students is a kind of incredulity toward me as a political science instructor, that I care so much about politics, something about which you can do nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Their notion is, why would you even be so concerned about something that you were powerless to change?
Mm-hmm.
But that's not your story at all. And you are bringing the sort of flip side of that coin. How did you turn to politics instead of just being a scrupulous consumer who never uses a plastic bag, instead of trying to reduce your ecological footprint as an individual? How did you make that leap into thinking that there were possibilities and potentialities in sort of group political action?
Yeah, I think I was really challenged by that idea that... I'm trying to think of how to say this. So that's a really, really great question. And I'm thinking about my history. Like, I don't know if I necessarily had a turning point. But somewhere along the way, I realized that, like, oh, just because I bring my own reusable bag to the grocery store, like, doesn't mean that's creating the change that needs to happen. Like, we are up against really big industries that are polluting the environment, that are oppressing people. There are these systems that aren't working for everybody, and the world that I want to see is that these systems do work for everybody and that everyone is included in our democracy. And so I think from early on in my activism was seeing how large groups of people coming together is what creates that change. And it was because I had mentors who really believed in that and were sort of showed me books and ideas and brought me to rallies and things like that. And so actually my turning point, we can argue about whether it was effective or not, was Occupy. So I was in college when the Occupy movement started, and I was in this class taught by Dr. Jules Boykoff called The Suppression of Dissent. And there we dove into this history of protest in America, as well as government and corporate efforts to suppress that protest and that dissent in many different ways. Highly recommend the work from Dr. Boykoff. But we were in this class talking about these different things, and as it relates to the civil rights movement and some of the animal rights movements and things like that, and then Occupy was starting in New York. And it was really fascinating to be using this like academic theoretical lens to be talking about something that was like happening right now, because right out of Occupy came a lot of protests and a lot of police clashes and things like that, and Occupy Portland. So I went to a small school outside of Portland, and Occupy Portland was starting, and it was something that my whole class was like, we need to go to this to experience this and to see it for ourselves. And for me, it was such a huge turning point, and just like witnessing tens of thousands of people in the streets all caring about so many different things, but at its core was like a desire to be heard in our government, a desire for corporate greed to be out of politics, and this desire for justice, whatever form of justice that is, social justice, racial justice, economic justice, environmental justice. And for me, that moment of seeing tens of thousands of people in Portland and then across the country uniting together on all of these different platforms was really powerful. And sure, it fizzled out. There's a lot of things that happened with it. But for me, just like witnessing firsthand what that mobilization can do and everything that sprung from it was a huge turning point. And I think for a lot of young people, it can be hard. There's things that you care about, but it's really easy to feel disillusioned by the process, because the process wasn't made for us, right? It wasn't made for people of color. It wasn't made for young people. For a large time, it wasn't made for women. And so, like, we're still working through those systems. And because of that, I think, like, we're sort of like this cultural belief that then we shouldn't try and try to try to change things. But I think we're also now seeing a huge shift globally. Young people have been leading the way. The youth climate strikes have been massive. Millions of people turning out. The Parkland students really leading the way in March for Our Lives against gun violence and efforts like that. And so I think we're starting to see a little bit of a paradigm shift, but it can be easy to be caught up in our local mm-hmm. bubbles.
So when you talk about the impact of these mass demonstrations, one of the things that's been on my mind is the effectiveness of those demonstrations seems to be contingent on leaders who care about public opinion mm-hmm. and what people think. Mm-hmm. And we currently would arguably have an administration that has little to no regard for public opinion on a host of major issues. So how does, agree or not mm-hmm. first, but if that does sound accurate, how does that impact that kind of strategy of mass mobilization? And is that model still viable, but with adaptations, or do you need to think very differently?
Yeah, I think there's so many different models, and I think sometimes folks can get caught up in like what is the best model or the right model, but I think the answer just depends on like what is the policy we're trying to change, who are we targeting, who is the decision maker, and what makes most sense for that group or that individual. And I think it's all of these strategies coming together that have the potential to create something really beautiful. And there's a lot of theory behind that. I think what like drew me to Ford, Montana was, so I was, you know, working in environment and climate issues, really like feel very strongly about those issues. And at the same time, like working on the environment and climate issues is like banging your head against the wall. Like things, if you're working on conservation and public lands, a lot of it's really slow moving processes that take years to go through, like a forest plan revision. And on climate, obviously, like scientists have been raising that alarm for decades. And like we've seen year after year, the extreme effects of climate change, but yet like not a lot of progress. Until I would say the past couple years, when things like the Green New Deal that were probably, and the ideas from that that were probably like not spoken about in like really public ways now are. And so I think we're just starting to see that shift, but that's because it's all of these different strategies coming together, from folks doing sit-ins to folks writing policy papers and briefs and working with companies and working on the inside. But also it requires sometimes changing those elected leaders. And so, like I was saying, one of the things that drew me to Ford, Montana was really, like, we are about reshaping the state's electorate so we can have better representation in government who will pass policies that the next generation really believes in. And so it's all these things together, and that's sort of the piece of the pie that we take.
Do you, this is Steve again, do you divide your attention between electoral politics and movements of people? I mean, do you separate it out that way? Do you believe that one side is more influential than another? For example, if we were to, let's say, elect all the wonderful progressive people that we that could ever fill the positions in government, if our government was full of progressive people, would you say it's a success that the job has been completed?
No, absolutely not, because there is always work to be done. And so I will say, as individually, I'm a huge fan of President Obama, but there is a lot of things that weren't so great, you know, that came out of his administration. And like immigrant rights activists would really harp on a lot of the harmful policies that his administration came down with that are just like really now being exposed more into the public eye. So I think we can elect really good leaders. However, that there's still so much more, like they still have so many pressures. I just think about, like, how hard it can be a decision sometimes in my friend group to, like, appeal to everybody and deciding, like, where we want to eat or do something, much less, like, running a state or a country and having to decide, like, the fate of millions of people. And so, no, like, we could definitely, like, it helps, of course, and we want people who are reasonable and can look at all sides and can think deeply about the issues and make these decisions that really protect the rights of the marginalized, but while also thinking in the best interests of everyone. But it takes the people to hold those elected leaders accountable.
How does Ford, Montana sort of work the scales, if I'm saying this in any kind of intelligible way, of, you know, elective positions and electoral politics versus movements and actions from citizens?
I would say we are really heavily engaged in voter registration and then giving young people the tools that they need to advocate and the skills. So that is where I wouldn't put us on either side, but I think we are more providing the home and the opportunity for people to mobilize, to get involved in the issues, to gain those skills. But we will, through the process, I would say we're probably more engaged on the election side, but we will be involved in the legislative session. And we're talking through right now, like, what does it mean to hold leaders accountable and how can we do so in a way that holds our values and fights for the beliefs that things that we want.
So it's more on the electoral side. So you're focusing on voter awareness, voter registration, trying to find good candidates, and then once they're in office, trying to remain a presence in their mind, encouraging them to do the things that you believe are the right things to do.
Yeah, I would say that with the caveat being that in all of that, we are thinking about, like, what is a long-term vision, which sets us apart from other organizations, from any political party. Like, we are very strictly nonpartisan, is that we are thinking for, like, the interests of our young generation. And what are, like, we're not just going to support anybody who might have progressive values. We're going to support people who really understand, like, why young people are really important and who will champion and fight for those issues. And so we are constantly thinking about what does the longer term movement mean and how are we developing young leaders who can be sustained in the movement, but while mostly being involved on the electoral side.
Mm-hmm. So when you're deciding to throw your support behind a particular candidate, let's say, do you have a winnowed down list of the most important issues? And if you do, what would you say those are? Like, a candidate that Ford Montana would support would be someone who was in favor of ding, ding, ding.
I would separate those two questions. I would just say, in general, the issues that we consistently hear about from young people is around economic justice, primarily around student debt and affordable housing, climate and conservation, and equality. Those are the top three things that young people always talk to us about. So across everything that we do, I would say like those issues in mind are embedded. And so then when we're looking at different candidate works, and I want to be clear that our electoral candidate work is very separate from our voter registration work because we are a nonpartisan organization and register voters from all walks of life. And specifically when we're looking at our candidates, our political committee, which is made up of board members who sit on Ford Montana, they make those decisions. And we're looking at what races do we think we can have an impact on, specifically like at what where young people can have an impact. We're looking at races that we think young people will be excited about and care about. And also, where do folks fall on those like three main issues?
Kirsten, you mentioned earlier that in 2018, Montana had the greatest increase amongst youth voting in the United States, which is something certainly to be commended. So in relation to the voting percentages amongst other age groups, where did Montana youth fall? And kind of a related question, overall, nationwide, I know we still see youth are voting at lower rates than other age groups, despite years and years of a lot of, frankly, time and money being put into organizations like Rock the Vote comes to mind and many others. So what is the barrier there that needs to be overcome to get more young people engaged in voting? Do you have any thoughts on that question as well?
Yeah, I think it's the investment in local groups that really make or break the difference. So there are a lot of national efforts like Rock the Vote, like you mentioned, that are trying to get young people excited. And to some extent those work, but it's young people in the localities that we're talking about, like it's that peer-to-peer engagement that is what's really effective. And that's what makes Ford Montana so effective, because we know how to reach our peers the best. We know what they care about. We know what those talking points are, and we know what those barriers are for them to entry. And so it's that one-on-one dialogue that is really what makes our work effective and being able to increase the youth vote, because it is lower and it's lower across the country. And I would say a lot of those barriers are, one, just like thinking that politics aren't for me, like, right, especially now that the country is becoming so polarized and a lot of people, especially young people, they're going off to college, or even if they're non-college youth, are starting to figure out what is their own political identity that's apart from their family. And I think we see a lot of that in Montana. So there's just a lot of questioning of like, who am I and like, what do I believe in? As well as just like, trying to understand, trying to navigate, like, what are all these different things on the ballot, which is why our voter education work is so important. And then there's other things that, like, people don't think about as much as, like, making sure that you have a stamp to send in your ballot. We're seeing now, right now, because of COVID, the states and counties are actually covering that, which is awesome. That's been a big barrier. And then there's other efforts to misinform and disinform voters that have come from even from the Secretary of State's office down to just misinformation around the internet. And so there's a lot of these different barriers that inhibits young people, and I would say also people of color and other marginalized identities. But I think one of the other biggest barriers is that people don't see themselves reflected in politics. And it's that lack of representation that kind of leads to this feeling of like, well, those people don't understand me. Why should I vote for them to begin with?
Right. Do you feel like the recent election of many, especially young women who are also people of color to U.S. Congress, is having a big impact on changing that?
Oh, absolutely. Obviously, like AOC and her squad, I think has definitely has started to turn the tide on the conversation. And I think locally, we're seeing that as well. And you know, a lot more women are being elected. A lot more women are throwing their names into the hat, and so I think that's a really great start. However, it's also making sure that folks aren't just thrown out to dry, but that they have the support and the tools that they need to succeed.
So you mentioned direct kind of voter registration drives and some of what's going on now with COVID-19. I'm wondering how that's going to impact both, you know, the registration efforts, which typically are done face-to-face with canvassers, right?
Yeah.
Or tablers. And then also, I know there was a pending lawsuit. There was initial court decision ruling in favor of Western Native Voice, an indigenous rights organization that was challenging a voter initiative that banned ballot collecting and delivery of more than 6 ballots at a time, and put some fairly onerous restrictions on having to fill out potentially time-consuming forms to even be able to deliver that small number of ballots. Is that also impactful on the student vote?
Absolutely. So I'll address those in a couple different parts. So first off, COVID has essentially eliminated in-person voter registration in the state. We feel like it is not safe to send people out. Like, we have young people interacting with large amounts of other people, that we have serious health risks. However, one of the things that Ford Montana is great at is being really innovative, creative, and meeting the challenges of the times. So we have two different avenues for that. One, we are working with the Voter Participation Center, which is a national group that works on mailing voter registration forms to unregistered and inactive voters. So we are, in June, there'll be a mailer going out to just under 100,000 unregistered and inactive voters in Montana. And we also have some plans to essentially what we were calling like voter registration chase program to like ensure that those folks see that in the mail and fill it out. And then secondly, we partnered with Western Native Voice, MontPerg, and Big Sky 55 Plus on a and Montana Women Vote on an online voter registration portal. So Montana is one of 11 states that does not offer online voter registration. However, even with the states that do offer online voter registration, or OVR, as we call it, there's still a lot of challenges. Like, in some states, even if you fill out your registration form online, you still have to print it out, you have to put the postage on it, you have to mail it, which is all those different layers to folks just is, like, greatly reduces their likelihood to turn it in. So online OVR in some of those states present those challenges. So what we've done is we've created our own portal that allows people to fill out the form, most of the form online. We will actually mail it out and print it out and mail the form to the registrant, who will sign it, and we are providing them with the postage to then mail it to their local county office. And that's been really successful. So we had it up for a week and didn't do too much promotion on it. But collectively, as a coalition, we secured over 200 voter registration forms, which is actually really good for the state of Montana for not doing too much promotion. And Ford Montana specifically, we received over 70 signups, including young people from like Judith Gap. Judith Gap, that has less than 2,000 people. There's an 18-year-old there. We had young people in Huntley and some of the tribal communities. And so this was like a really incredible tool that I think even when we're allowed to, even when we are registering folks in person, to use, because we're able to reach people who we wouldn't have been able to reach otherwise. So that's been super exciting, and we're excited to see the success. And in conversations that I've been having with similar organizations in other states, it sounds like what we've been able to do can be a model, because we have also able to do it in a timely manner, where some of those other national groups who do similar services have a really long lag time. So that's been really exciting, really, really excited about that. And then, Jeff, to some of your questions around BIPA, so the Ballot Interference Protection Act, Prevention Act, I get confused with what the P is.
Yeah, I think so.
We are extremely excited that the courts have the temporary restraining order on the ballot collection. So students really, that's been one of our big tactics to collecting ballots from students, has been that. We also think that restricting ballot collection right now in the time of COVID doesn't make sense, because it's just a lot easier and safer to have one person collecting many ballots and dropping it off than everyone going to the county office. So that's been, we are very supportive of the lawsuit going on with Western Native Voice, led by ACLU.
We brought in this question of the ballot collection. I should give a quick explanation of why Western Native Voice and other Indigenous groups are engaged in this. You know, on many of the reservations, such as on Fort Belknap Reservation, you have communities like Hayes and Lodgepole that are a solid hour drive from the Fort Belknap Agency, where the county seat is, and under the best of conditions, an hour long drive. So it's obviously a pretty major investment of time and energy for people just to deliver their ballot, and by preventing people from collecting ballots from other members of their community, and even in their own household, you know, many households have more than six people under one roof, it's creating quite a suppression to voting amongst the Native populations. Just wanted to throw that explanation out there for folks who may not have been following this.
Yes.
I thought you had a question waiting, Steve.
I don't think the viewer audience saw you look over here. Do you feel that there is one thing that's way more important than other things?
Oh, no.
How do you organize around everything being important?
That is always the everyday question for just figuring out life tasks. So I would say for us as an organization, we do have core values and like priority programs, voter registration, voter education, mobilization, and leadership development. And everything that we falls within that. And we have a very clear theory of change, a peer-to-peer engagement with young people. And that is our lane. And that's why we also work closely with other organizations that do similar work with us around the state, who might reach out to different populations, all with the ultimate goal. But that is, like, we are very focused in those areas, and I think very successful at it, and have made quite the name for ourselves around the state.
Just want to take a moment to remind folks you are listening to KGVM 95.9 FM in Bozeman, online at kgvm.org. You're listening to The View From Here with your co-hosts Jeff Milchin and Steve Kirchhoff, and today we are interviewing Kirsten Ewy of Forward Montana.
I guess the reason I asked that question is because I find reality to be overwhelming for myself personally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I'm always using this radio show to calm my beating heart and ask people questions who have thought about it more and do more work around it and have more experience about it. And I see you as one of those people. And I have talked to people who have actually done that kind of a prioritization, at least in their own minds. And you may agree or disagree or just have a healthy way of like integrating their thought process into yours. But what has come out for me and in these conversations is climate change, global warming. That's number one. If we don't fix that, nothing else matters. You know what I mean? If we don't have a place to call home and a place to lay our heads down at the end of the day, what's the point in working on voter registration rights? What is the point in working on the court case regarding the proper closure of the mine? What is the, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I know that you have already answered that question, and I'm just duplicating it in more words, but could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, no,
because
okay,
let me just put it this way.
Yeah.
What do you make of that notion?
Yeah.
That climate change is number one. Everything else, though important, is subordinate to it, simply because without a place to be, all the questions about how we should be are irrelevant.
Yeah. Well, and to that I say, especially coming from somebody who has a strong climate background, is that so many of the climate solutions are really the solutions that will make our world a more just and equitable place about all of these other different issues that we're talking about. And so much of the causes to climate change are stemming from the things that justice advocates are fighting against and fighting for. And there's a myriad of issues with climate change that sort of like all are into one bundle, and the solutions out of that are across all the different sectors and all the different fields. And so I think now we're having this realization that it's not just about shutting down coal plants or stopping oil and gas and like getting more solar panels and windmills. It's about doing the solution, like we have the time and the chance now to do these solutions in a way that will benefit everybody. And I truly believe that voting is a right that everybody deserves and should be able to have the chance and access to our democracy. And so much of the solutions to climate change is only possible if we have a healthy democracy where everybody is able to make their voice heard. And so from there, everything else just stems from that.
Arguable. Yeah, because couldn't you imagine, let's say, a fascistic country that also saw the light about global warming and just basically said, me and my friends, we're shutting down coal, we're shutting down gas, right? And we're going to go to all whatever. So, I mean, you could imagine sweeping changes to energy provision and the way that the economy is driven.
Mm-hmm.
the power system could change, the actual power for the lights and for mm-hmm. the transportation and for the production of goods, that could change without there being a more egalitarian society in its way, don't you think?
Yes, it could. And then I think it goes back to sort of that original point of like, well, what's the point of all these other issues if we don't actually have a planet to live on? It's also, what's the point of living on the planet if people don't have a say, if people's rights aren't respected, if folks are still oppressed? Like,
right.
I think it's also that.
And when I hear that kind of framing of climate, I think I mean, almost only could come from people in our position who are fairly privileged and white, because we're talking just a few days after the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis. 3 days later, there's been no arrest of any officer involved for a clear-cut, videotaped every step of the action murder committed on camera. And so, you know, I try to sometimes put myself in those shoes of, you know, can't do it. I can't imagine the level of rage that that must swell up. But that kind of framing of what takes priority, I mean, that necessarily takes a different form depending on what your situation in life is, right? I liked your framing of Kirsten that, you know, it's not a matter of one taking precedent over the other. It's a matter of keeping them all in mind, right? And mm-hmm. figuring out how to apply them. Sorry to go off on a little tangent, but I think that's something that's certainly been on my mind a lot this week. And I'm wondering, Kirsten, being, you know, a young Japanese-American woman, when you hear a lot of the rhetoric coming out of from Donald Trump, from Montana Senator Steve Daines, scapegoating China for the COVID crisis, putting out a lot of inflammatory language that has indirectly led to a lot of hate crimes around the country, people being targeted because they somehow look Asian and are being harassed and sometimes even physically attacked. What does that bring up for you when you hear that kind of mm-hmm. language being used, not only by, you know, white supremacist groups, but by a U.S. senator, by the president of the United States?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would say even by more left-leaning elected and leaders as well. Yeah, it sucks. Like, I think COVID especially has just really shown us how our systems are either broken, or you could argue that they were designed to oppress people and uplift other people. But either way, COVID has really exposed all of this. And a lot of the anti-Asian sentiment is nothing new that we've seen in this country. We saw it when Chinese immigrants first came over here and were building the railroads, and how they were purposely excluded from like really prominent photos, historical photos of like really what push this country into its next era, its next chapter in its life. We saw that with Japanese internment. My family was in Hawaii during World War II. So fortunately, kind of weird to say, my grandparents were questioned, of course, about their loyalty. But my grandpa also served during, my grandpa's brother also served during World War II. And because we were not in California or on the contiguous United States, were not subjected to the internment camps, but that was another obviously really dark spot in history by a president who also had really incredible social policies. Yeah, this anti-Asian rhetoric is nothing new and not surprising, unfortunately. I think that the inflammatory comments that are made from leaders really essentially give folks, perceive it as a license to do as they want and want with. I also think, though, there is also work in the Asian community that can be done to really show that, like, stand in solidarity with the Black community, with Indigenous peoples. There's, you know, you often hear about the model minority myth of Asian people, which has really been a tool for those in privilege, largely, like, white men, to be like, well, this group of people did it, why can't you? And that's really been used as a wedge tool to divide, like, the different ethnicities and races, all under this, you know, category of Black, Indigenous, and people of color. And so there's just, like, everything that's been happening in the past week has just raised so much for those, for me personally, and, like, thinking about what is my role. And, of course, every time I step outside, I wonder, is somebody going to yell at me? Is somebody going to attack me? You know, and it's not fun. And it's scary. And I also think about, though, like, what is happening to young black men in this country who are literally being killed by the very people who should be protecting us. And so there's a lot there. There's a lot to unpack, and it's always been there. And now, just because we have these tools, we're able to see it. Although, unfortunately, we couldn't just take people's words for it. We had to, like, witness, you know, these awful videos firsthand. But now that we are starting to have these conversations, and in the past, I guess, decade, there's also been a lot out there that are giving people the tools to have these conversations, because I just don't think we have the tools, all of us have the tools, to effectively talk about these hard things.
So I'm curious, when you talked about anti-Asian sentiment being nothing new, I certainly am very well aware of some of the history you mentioned, but tell me if this is just a giant blind spot on my part. It seems like in the past couple of decades, I haven't been aware of much of that. What have I been missing in terms of more recent anti-Asian speech actions? Mm-hmm. Can you enlighten us on that a little bit?
Yeah, and I wouldn't say I'm aware of any specific incidents. I think there's been a couple, like, violent ones, but I would say more so, it stems, I don't know if you've all have seen the iceberg, where there's, like, at the top of the iceberg, or the racism iceberg at the top is, like, really overt, in-your-face violent acts, and then down below is sort of, like, all of these things that our culture does that still oppresses people. And I think in the past couple of decades, we've really seen that model minority myth really take over, and to the point where you have, like, Asian groups who are suing against some of the affirmative action policies that were meant to help people, and really those are led by white people who really using Asian people as, like, the front. And if you break down, Asia is a massive continent with so many different countries, and if you break that down even further, like, based on people, places of origin, and their ethnicities, there's a huge disparity between people, Cambodians versus like Japanese, like me. And so there's all of these just different disparities that are broken down within that. When you think about pay and access to education and quality of healthcare and all of the different social categories that you can think of.
So I'm curious, for Forward Montana, you talk about, you know, engaging diverse group of young people. Are you specifically engaging in any kind of anti-racist action around, you know, some of what's happened, like the incident up in Havre, where a woman was forced to relocate out of the community due to community harassment in the wake of a U.S. Border Patrol official detaining her and a friend simply for the offense of speaking Spanish in the state of Montana? Anything that's going on and encountering that kind of upwelling of racism that's a little more subtle than the white supremacist groups out in certain parts of Western Montana?
Yeah. And so I would say it's definitely an organizational journey, and there's been a lot of conversations both before I started and then now that I have started, trying to think through that. So we're doing a lot of work within our own organization to make sure that we have the tools to talk about it, to make sure that we're engaging as really good partners and allies. Because in my experience, especially coming from the conservation and environmental world, there's a lot of times where, like, oh, we need to diversify, we need to do something, and then you do something the wrong way, and it is so much more harmful than as if you just, like, worked on your own shit to begin with. And so we're doing a lot internally there. So last year we went through a racial equity audit with a consultant to figure out just where are we at. And this year we're hoping to go through, work with somebody who will do trainings for staff and board so that we can have the tools to talk about it amongst ourselves and also with our partners. And then have some sort of racial equity plan as well. I would say that our work sort of comes into twofold in that space, and that is when we're in coalition spaces, really being the voice to support Montana Racial Equity Project and Western Native Voice in spaces to ensure that all of these perspectives are being heard, because we have found that that is often overlooked, and if we're the only ones in the room, it is up to us to be seeing some things or supporting our partners in that. And then also being supportive of groups like Western Native Voice and Montana Racial Equity Project, who we have really good relationships with. When COVID started for us, I was looking at, like, where are we at with our cash flow and our budget and everything, and it was important to us to support some of these other groups. And so as an organization, we gave Montana Racial Equity Project some money to support their Black Student Fund that they had, their crisis fund, as well as a food bank service with the Crow Reservation. So those were just a couple of the things, and right now we're figuring out what more publicly we want to do around the killing of George Floyd and things like that. But of course, we are really supportive of community efforts to do that. We just really want to make sure that they're done in a way that is actually helpful and like demonstrates true allyship than like really shallow and superficial action, which I think we also see a lot of in this community.
Tokenism, in other words, is what you're referring to.
Yes, yeah, and like our organization is not immune to that type of behavior either. We've been called out for it, so it's definitely a journey.
So when you talked about Forward Montana's funding, tell us a little bit about what, you know, where you draw your funding and support from, if you don't mind.
Yeah, so like most organizations, or maybe all organizations, our funding comes from two main sources: individual contributions, so that's people in the community or folks who live maybe out of state but have a connection to Montana and who know about us, who like the work that we do, as well as grants, both in state and out of state grants, but folks who really funders who really care about civic engagement, getting young people involved, as well as some of our issue advocacy work. We don't really do any of those, like, hire us to do something program service, mm-hmm. fee for service. Yeah, we don't engage in that, really.
And what kind of reach do you have across the state, Kirsten, in terms of, you know, email subscribers, followers?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we have about 7,000 email subscribers, largely around the state. I actually do not know about our Instagram and Facebook, but we have two organizations, Forward Montana Foundation, which really is a house for our more civic engagement voter registration work, and Forward Montana, which houses more of our political work.
All right. So during the current election cycle, and we're called reading on your website that you've hosted candidate forums, so mm-hmm. is there going to be any attempt in the federal races for the U.S. House or U.S. Senate to actually host a youth-focused candidate forum this year?
Yes, absolutely. We're really excited about that. And we are, hopefully we'll have candidate forums, whether or not we have to be social distancing, we'll figure out something right. if we are not allowed to have it in person. But we are talking about doing that for the it'd be like for the larger statewide races, Senate, House, Governor, as well as more of the local and Tier B races. We think it would be really exciting and important to have candidate forums around like the State Auditor, Secretary of State, Attorney General, because those are really critical and important seats that just involve in state governance, but that nobody knows anything about. And so I'm particularly excited about those.
I'm still sitting over here stewing.
Uh-oh.
I've been stewing for like 12 minutes on the question about the many versus the one, about the fragmentation that I see as fragmentation. You might not see it that way. You probably won't see it that way, of so many issues, right? Mm-hmm. There's so many issues right now. It's like a civilization that's basically kind of collapsing, right? It's like a person who cannot have basic decency. Mm-hmm. There are so many ways that the person, if we think of our country as a person, there's so many ways this person's broken
mm-hmm.
that we don't even know where to start. But there's always a place to start. In fact, there's too many places to start. And that's my problem, is the fragmentation of concentration on trying to turn things towards something better for all.
Yeah.
And because it is all, of course there's some inevitable fragmentation, but you know, when I was a kid growing up, there was Martin Luther King and there was a civil rights movement, and that helped to empower people suffering under Jim Crow laws. And then there was the Equal Rights Amendment, the effort mm-hmm. of women to get equal pay, equal rights, and have that inscribed in the Constitution. There were, of course, always the struggles of labor unions, and there were things that would flare up here and there, but it seemed like it was one at a time. And what I'm feeling the weight of is the many, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's just so many issues. And after I asked you the question, well, what about the climate? Isn't that the Trump card? Sorry to say Trump. And you said, no, not if people are not treated with basic decency, and if there's so much exclusion and power mm-hmm. inequities, what's the point in fixing the climate? So I see that as a good comeback. Maybe the Green New Deal.
Yeah, it is so overwhelming to think about all of these different issues. And on top of that, we're still in the midst of a global pandemic and people's health is on the line. And I get that and I feel that every day. At the same time, we don't really have a choice. We have to address all of these issues, and all of these issues are connected, and so that means all of the solutions are connected. And so as we think about what world do we want to move towards, where do we want to be, as we start unraveling the mess and all of these problems, we find that it's the same underlying things that are exacerbating them. Corporate greed, racism, white supremacy, colonialism, misogyny, all of these things. And when we look at the solutions to create a better society, they're all intertwined. And I also think about, like, if we look back at different moments in history, there was intentional choices that leaders made that included some and excluded others. Like, we look at the women's suffrage movement, one of what used to be one of my favorite moments in history because it gave women the right to vote. However, it excluded Black women and Black men and other people of color. It was a very intentional choice by white women to exclude these other people. And if they had included, right, like the civil rights movement would have looked totally different. And so because of those choices made in the past, we are now having to answer them in such drastic and radical ways that is really hard to wrap our brains around.
That's a really interesting observation about the civil rights movement and how different history could have been with a little bit more collaboration between folks interested in racial justice and women's rights and civil rights at the time. So building on that, what kind of work is Forward Montana engaged in when it comes to racial justice? And I think we mentioned earlier we're recording, you know, just days after the killing of George Floyd. Has that brought on any new discussions amongst your staff about how that might influence your work?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something that the organization has been grappling with for a while about just how do we deal with our own shit and our own problems and work towards it. And also, how do we be good partners and allies? And so when we were founded, our organization, our founders really believed in an equitable Montana where all people could thrive. And they believed that Montana would be stronger, more just, and a better place to live if the diverse voices of our generation were elevated across the state. That's why we were founded, why we started, and it has been a journey. Our organization has had a lot of hiccups. They've made a lot of mistakes and have done some harm. And we've been working towards how do we be better? How do we be better partners and how do we be better allies? And so when I think about what is happening, I think about our partners. So we're part of this national alliance of organizations that are just like ours across the country, and some of our partners, like at Chicago Votes and Leaders Igniting Transformation in Wisconsin, they are fighting against police violence and racism and police in their schools and terrorizing the young people that they work with. And so we stand in solidarity with them and the efforts that they're doing. And here in Montana, also using our influence with progressive partners, with environmental nonprofits, to talk about why our organizations need to engage in racial justice at a deeper way. You know, I think about when our country was founded, the founding fathers intentionally drafted documents that excluded any and all non-white land-owning men, which is a really large portion of the population. And they purposefully declared Black slaves as not human enough with the Three-Fifths Compromise. And so by layering in white supremacy to our nation's founding, they ensured that racism would be ingrained into all of our nation's systems that would stand the test of time. And here we are, centuries later, still grappling with the same thing. And so as a civic engagement organization that deeply believes in our democracy and the rights the Constitution guarantees, we know that the health of our republic is as only as strong as the people who can fully participate in it. And for too long, people have not been able to fully participate in it. So when we think about elevating young voices, being better partners, strengthening our democracy, racial justice needs to be at the core of that. And yeah, we're a predominantly white-led organization, and we have some staff of color, but there's so many dynamics, and like just having staff of color doesn't solve everything. There needs to be so much more deeper involvement within that. So it's a challenge, but it's one that we need to take on, and we know that our partner organizations like Montana Racial Equity Project and Western Native Voice are suffering and feeling so much pain, and it is on us to do better and be better allies.
So, Kirsten, you mentioned groups like ours. Is there a network nationally of groups that are kind of similarly focused, but youth-led and youth-driven, like Forward Montana?
Yes, and Forward Montana is actually one of the founders of this. It used to be called the Bus Federation, because it was about busing young people around to help knock on doors and things like that. But now it's called the Alliance for Youth Organizing and the Alliance for Youth Action. There are about 10 affiliate organizations around the country, most representing states, but some are really localized. And then there's probably about another 10 that are youth organizing projects, other youth organizations around the country as well.
Excellent. And so what kind of resources do you gain through that kind of national network?
Yeah, so it's largely has shifted over the past couple years, but really the network is a place for young EDs, young executive directors like myself, to get together, to support each other, to navigate all of the different challenges there are, just with one, running an organization, two, running a youth-led organization, and three, all the other, you know, things that are happening in the world. And so I don't know what I would be doing if I didn't have that support. I would be a lot more of a wreck than I have been. But the Alliance also helps connect us with funders who might be interested in our work, connect us with learning opportunities to go to conferences. They put on about every year, maybe every other year, they put on a national conference for all of the affiliates to come together, not just the EDs, but our staff as well, so we can feel really connected to this broader network of young people around the country who are doing the similar work. And now we're starting to think about how can we exert our influence and power in the national space and really affecting policy change at the national level.
All right. So being based in Bozeman, I'm curious, do you have a presence in communities in eastern Montana, Kirsten, or doing any active outreach in, say, east of Billings?
Yeah, so unfortunately, we don't have any staff presence east of Billings. So we have year-round staff in Billings, Missoula, Great Falls, and Billings, like I have said before. However, we will be looking to hire some part-time organizers that can be located anywhere around the state. So we're really excited about that opportunity. Additionally, our staff person in Great Falls is a rural outreach coordinator, and she is tasked with organizing young people in communities outside of any of these core communities that we work in. And our high school program also engages with young people all across the state. And so we've had engagement in places like the Flathead and farther out in Haver and places like that.
So what does that look like in terms of engagement with high school students? Do you try to come in and do guest presentations in the classes, or what other forms of work does that take?
Yeah, and we are so excited about our high school program. It's a growing program, and this starting in January was the first time we've had full-time capacity, so we're still really growing that out. But our high school program has three components. One is what we call underage democracy, and these are civic engagement templates that we work with educators and high school students to engage their peers on things like the Montana budget, the judicial system, really Montana-specific learning opportunities. We have Democracy Days, that's a peer-to-peer voter registration drive, and that this is usually held in the spring. Unfortunately, we've had to reschedule it because of COVID to the fall, but we have 20 schools participating where high school students are having their own voter registration drives on their campuses over the course of a couple days. And then the third component is our high school fellowship program, where we, this year, we're having 10 high school fellows in the fall who are paid a small stipend to learn about more about civic engagement, build some organizing skills, and really work with their fellow peers at their high schools on being involved in the elections. They have their own get out the vote, they register voters, they we're talking about what is it like for high school fellows to do their own education around the school board or around the Office of Public Instruction and things like that. So it's super fun and exciting. It's open to any high schooler that is really interested in civic engagement.
Great. That's really inspiring to hear.
Yeah.
So Kirsten, we're just about out of time, so maybe you could just tell us how can folks best learn more about Forward Montana's work or get involved?
Yeah, so our website is one good place. You can go to forwardmontana.org or forwardmontanafoundation.org. You can also find us on Instagram and Facebook. Send us an email, go into our slide, into our DMs. We are always interested and excited to talk about all things voting and civic engagement.
Well, thank you so much for joining us this week, Kirsten. You've been listening to The View From Here, and our special guest this week, Kirsten Ewy of the Forward Montana Foundation and Forward Montana Organization. We'll see you next time on KGVM 95.9 FM Bozeman and online at kgvm.org.